for example, that initially the language that I used to describe what was happening in women's prisons was very homophobic, and I was a product of my time. And it is I should say, inspiring to recognize how far we have come, not only in the way we talk about sexuality, but the way we talk about gender, and the way we are constantly challenging binary notions of gender. And all of these transformations have happened as a consequence of the fact that people have dedicated themselves to struggle for an end to racism, to imperialism, to war, an end to misogyny. And let me say that in rereading that text,
we have 20 seconds.
I became aware of the absolute importance of anti-racist, anti-capitalist, abolitionist feminism.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being with us, Angela Y. Davis, a world-renowned abolitionist, author, activist, distinguished professor emerita at the University of California, Santa Cruz. Two new books out this week, an updated edition of her autobiography. It's called Angela Davis, An Autobiography, and Abolition, Feminism Now. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe, wear a mask.
You're listening to Community Radio.
You are listening to KBOO FM, Portland. The time is 8 a.m. Next up is Wednesday Talk Radio with Paul Roland.
My friends, that tomorrow is today. We are confronted with the fierce urgency of now. In this unfolding conundrum of life and history, that is such a thing as being too late. Procrastination is still the thief of time. Life often leaves us standing bare, naked, and dejected with a lost opportunity. Tied in the affairs of men does not remain at flooded ebbs. We may cry out desperately for time to pause in her passage, but time is adamant to every plea and rushes on. Over the bleached bones and jumbled residues of numerous civilizations, written the pathetic words too late.
Oh, time.
Faithfully records our vigilance or our neglect. Omar Khayyam is right to move in finger rights and having writ moves on. We still have a choice today. nonviolent coexistence of violent co-annihilation. We must move past indecision to action. If we do not act, we shall surely be dragged down the long, dark, and shameful corridors of time, reserved for those who possess power without compassion, might without morality, and strength without sight. Now let us begin. Now let us rededicate ourselves to the long and bitter but beautiful struggle for a new world.
Good morning, everybody. Apologies for that beginning. I was keeping our board operator, Ty, occupied beyond when I should have, trying to find a piece of audio from that Martin Luther King speech, Beyond Vietnam, that you heard a little snippet of. Anyway, I was looking at the clock, which was, the clocks are set differently from the time that there's a little bit of lag in the audio. And so anyway, we're apologies to Ty and everybody for that snafu at the beginning there. But this is Wednesday Talk Radio. I'm your host, Paul Rowland. I'll be with you live from our inner southeast studio here in Portland, Oregon, hard on the banks of the Willamette River, close by anyway. And yeah, I'm here by myself, so I'd like to talk to you, and the number to call in is 503-231-8187. So that was a mix that I put together, oh God, many years ago when I kind of soon after I first got back into being on the air here on KBOO and doing a lot of shows on climate change, on the fossil fuel madness. And it was probably around a Martin Luther King Jr. day that I once again heard that speech, which is just a mind-blowing speech. Really needs to be listened to, re-listened to, studied. Anyway, that phrase, the fierce urgency now of now, really got to me because if not now, when? If not us, who? If not here, where? No, I was thinking that just the words, the imagery, his passion, his mind, his spirit were just so finely attuned. He was just such an incredible spirit, that man. So tuned in to the realities, the truth of what was going on, I think, and open too. I mean, he really, risked a lot in making that speech, politically, personally, I think he got, one of the reasons he got killed is because that speech, ironically, happened exactly a year to the date after he made it. Of course, I'm not sure we will ever know exactly who gave the order, if that's indeed what happened. But anyway, I just think what I want to talk about today is the fierce urgency of now, and hearing Martin Luther King really gives me goosebumps, gets my blood going, gets me inspired. And why? What is it about a person and a person's voice that has that power to do that? And what is it in our own lives that can give us that? I mean, we can't depend on one person to do that for us. We see what happens to the one people who have that combination of charisma, intelligence, humanity, compassion. You know, obviously no one's perfect. King wasn't perfect, but he certainly, to me, embodied the kind of humanity that we really truly aspire to, in both a particularism based on his particular experience as an African American in a ugly racist society, and all the things that as a white person I'll never know, that one has the indignities and oppressions of daily life that one experiences. Yes, obviously that was who he was. But there's a universality, you know, that appealed to a wide variety of people, and that's why he was so dangerous. But again, I want to focus on the spiritual quality of being so present, so in the moment, so attuned that you're able to draw other people in, that other people are able to tune into that frequency, so to speak. And what is it? You know, unfortunately, in a mass society like this, where, you know, the tight-knit social fabric that characterized the, you know, tribal kinship societies that were here before the European colonization, that characterized the tribal kinship societies that, Africa was a very, very complex place, and America was a very, very complex place, and it wasn't all the same, but there's a fabric of society that was very different. Certainly there was, you know, kingships, and certainly there were, you know, oppressive situations, but there was a kind of I didn't want to get into all that, but the breakdown of those small, close-knit groups that had the ability to live on the planet for, you know, thousands of years and adapt to changing environments, that we've broken that down. Well, we have these huge, impersonal, hierarchical, patriarchal societies that don't have the kind of connection that even, you know, even proletarian working class societies had and were able to build upon that human solidarity. Anyway, what I'm saying is that absent that kind of really close-knit solidarity, it takes sometimes a figure like a Martin Luther King to move the masses. It takes the kind of grassroots organizers to galvanize people. It takes sometimes that combination of grassroots, often women, who are galvanizing people in their communities to take action. And sometimes these more universal charismatic figures like a King or like a Malcolm X, or, you know, you name the kind of leaders that we've seen who've moved, who've helped create large social movements. Anyway, so that's what I want to talk about, the fierce urgency of now, and, you know, carrying on the conversation from the film Don't Look Up, which I heard on the Old Mole, I heard Joe and Jan talk about that. It was very well thought out. That was last Monday, critique of the film, and I agreed with much of what they were saying. the one takeaway that I just want to return to, which is what I talked about a couple weeks ago, which is the sense of the impending urgency, using the metaphor of a comet, which is, you know, a controversial one, criticizable one, but it really strikes at the heart of what I feel anyway, of the emergency that we're in on the planet with our disruption of Earth's ecosystems, the disruption of the climate. And it's so far beyond that. I was listening to a report on NPR about the production of chemicals, tens of thousands of chemicals that are released into our environment that we're exposed to on a daily basis that we have almost no real testing for in real life, in a real ecosystem situation where, you know, we're seeing that the loss of insect species, bird species, just the massive chemicalization of our environment is, you know, is part of what's happening to the climate. But what's happening is just so much more vast. We just have so little idea what's going on. Anyway, the urgency of the situation that we're in is really sometimes hard. It's both hard to grasp because it's so big and overwhelming, and it can render us somewhat powerless. It's like, well, how do we even comprehend, let alone deal with what's going on? So again, sometimes voices like Martin Luther King, sometimes, you know, hearing someone reflect back a real deeper understanding of what's happening can really help us, help galvanize our own thoughts, help galvanize us to action, you know, as what happened in the late 50s and early 60s, which King certainly wasn't, you know, he came in, you know, in the middle of it, really. There was already bus boycotts. There was already movement going on. You know, he was just part of a bigger movement, which is, you know, often the case. It's hard for an individual to really stand out and step out and become a leader unless there's something bigger already happening. It's kind of a joint process. All right, well, I'm going to play a little more of that talk just because I want to focus on some specific things that he was talking about. This idea that it may be too late. There's the fierce urgency of now, but there's the possibility, which he warns against, which I've never really heard anybody express the way King does in this talk, about the possibility that you can, you know, you just may not be able to respond to what's going on in the timely fashion that's necessary. And some of us fear that it may be that with the climate crisis, but we can't let that paralyze it. We need to let that become the motivator for our, you know, even if we can't control what happens on the larger levels of what's happening physically, geochemically to the planet, we must still act in a way that does the best of our humanity. All right, I'm going to shut up and let's go to hear more of the Beyond Vietnam talk of Martin Luther King in 1967.
Thanks for the saving choice of life and good against the damning choice of death and evil. Therefore, the first hope in our inventory must be the hope that love is going to have the last word, unquote. We are now faced with the fact, my friends, that tomorrow is today. We are confronted with the fierce urgency of now. In this unfolding conundrum of life and history, that is such a thing as being too late. Procrastination is still the thief of time. Life often leaves us standing bare, naked, and dejected with a lost opportunity. Tied in the affairs of men does not remain at flooded ebbs. We may cry out desperately for time to pause in her passage, but time is adamant to every plea and rushes on over the bleached bones and jumbled residues of numerous civilizations, written the pathetic words too late. That is an invisible book of life that faithfully records our vigilance or our neglect. Omar Khayyam is right to move in finger rights and having writ moves on. We still have a choice today, nonviolent coexistence, a violent co-annihilation. We must move past indecision to action. We must find new ways to speak for peace in Vietnam and justice throughout the developing world, a world that borders on our doors. We do not act. We shall surely be dragged down the long, dark, and shameful corridors of time, reserved for those who possess power without compassion, might without morality, and strength without sight. Now let us begin. Now let us rededicate ourselves to the long and bitter but beautiful struggle for a new world. This is the calling of the sons of God, and our brothers wait eagerly for our response. Shall we say the odds are too great? Shall we tell them the struggle is too hard? Will our message be that the forces of American life militate against their rival as poor men, and we send our deepest regrets? Will there be another message of longing, of hope, of solidarity with their yearnings, of commitment to their cause, whatever the cost? The choice is ours. And though we might prefer it otherwise, we must choose in this crucial moment of human history. As that noble bard of yesterday, James Russell Lowell, eloquently stated, once to every man and nation comes a moment to decide in the strife of truth and falsehood for the good or evil side. Some great cause, God's new Messiah, offering each the gloom of light, and the choice goes by forever twixt that darkness. Though the cause of evil prosper, yet his truth alone is strong. Though her portion be the scaffold, and upon the throne be wrong, yet that scaffold sways the future. Behind the dim unknown standeth God within the shadow, keeping watch above his own. And if we will only make the right choice, we will be able to transform this pending cosmic elegy into a creative psalm of peace. We will make the right choice. We will be able to transform the jangling discords of our world into a beautiful symphony of brotherhood. If we will but make the right choice, we will be able to speed up the day all over America and all over the world when justice will roll down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream.
All right. Well, I don't know about you, but that speech always does a lot for me. And so that's some things I would like to talk about this morning. If you would like to talk about them, you can call me at 503-231-8187. The fierce urgency of now. You know, it can cut both ways. Sometimes we can feel this intense urgency and yet be paralyzed, and that can double back on us. Just briefly share a personal experience. I don't know if this is apropos, but so I've always had a serious problem with intimacy on a personal level, romantic level, just reacting to the call of attraction, and just not very dealt with it very well. It's led me into problematic situations, but I had one situation where it was so strong and I procrastinated, as Martin Luther King says, and I actually turned into terrible anxiety. I guess this should put a trigger warning. This is kind of stuff that, I don't know, people have had experiences like this, they may not want to be reminded. But anyway, it turned really bad, turned into a manic episode. And So I guess all I'm saying is that the personal is the political, in the sense that I see all these things as being related, that we're in situations. It's all situational. We're in personal situations, we're in social situations, we're in political situations that require action. And if we don't, as Martin Luther King says, we can be stand naked and dejected. Anyway, I've been privileged to participate in some really powerful situations of movement where just things sort of clicked and we were able to respond in ways that were powerful. And I've seen it happen over and over again. The problem is what's happening now is at such a level that it really kind of beggars description. And at a time when we need to have some kind of global response, we find ourselves in falling back on the worst kind of nationalisms. So what is it going to take? How are we going to reignite the spark that we've seen happen over and over again in our history, people rising up? How are we going to respond to the comet that's headed toward us? Well, I'd really like to hear somebody else. I'm struggling a little bit here. So 503-231-8187 is the number to call in. I'd like to talk about the fierce urgency of now. This is no time like the present, as they say. 503-231-8187. Talking about Dr. Martin Luther King, his Vietnam, Beyond Vietnam speech given at Manhattan's Riverside Church, April 4, 1967. Beyond Vietnam, a time to break the silence. Well, maybe let's just go back to the original break we had at the beginning to start the show.
My friends, that tomorrow is today. We are confronted with the fierce urgency of now. In this unfolding conundrum of life and history, that is such a thing as being too late. Procrastination is still the thief of time. Life often leaves us standing bare, naked, and dejected with a lost opportunity. Tied in the affairs of men does not remain at flooded ebbs. We may cry out desperately for time to pause in her passage, but time is adamant to every plea and rushes on. Over the bleached bones and jumbled residues of numerous civilizations, written the pathetic words too late.
All time.
All right, we're back. Well, I apologize that in all my years of doing this program, doing radio, I've never floundered quite like that before. So time rushes on, as they say, and here we are in live radio. All right, I was hoping someone would call and save me, and someone did. So let's go to Jen, our first caller. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Hey, Paul, can you hear me okay?
Yep.
Great. Hey, I just want to say thanks again for your program. I really appreciate all your insights on your personal levels as well. They mean a lot to me. especially when you were talking about how much a few shows ago with Native American indigenous cultures, how much, you know, you've gotten to that at a younger age, and just, yeah, it's beautiful the way you weave things in. And the speech with Beyond Vietnam, a lot of people, Democracy Now!, some other shows on cable have been playing it, and I too get goosebumps and am just floored by how prophetic and just, like you say, how much of a spirit he had to just really convey such truths on such a on such a deep level. And his talk of, you know, really addressing capitalism and the disparities of wealth between, you know, the rich and the poor, you know, ever more present now, and pressing a need to address. And yeah, I just want to say thanks again for bringing this to our attention, to really have the need to really study the speech, because I agree. And then on the issue of urgency of now, I often find myself struggling with procrastination on a lot of different levels, and the urgency of now with climate change, I feel like recently, in the past few years of my life, I've been drawn to micro-remediation, regenerative agriculture, the power of sequestration of carbon from our atmosphere into our forests, and also now recognizing into regenerative agriculture farmlands, farmlands that are no-till agriculture, and how much, if we could transform our industrial wastelands of monocrop, you know, chemical, as you put out there, chemical pesticide use of farming that our country does in the names of, you know, oh, this is going to save the world with feeding the world. It's such a farce. It's one of the biggest lies, as a lot of us know. And how much regenerative agriculture, if we can transform our lands to this no-till way of farming, we can increase yields in food and food security for people, and B, we can sequester so much carbon. It's amazing. Prairie lands, bringing them back, also bringing back the soil. So for me, it's like the solution in my mind is we need to redirect our subsidies that we pay in our tax dollars to the fossil fuel industry, and redirect those subsidies to be able to retransform the farmlands to regenerative agriculture, because our farmers are going to need subsidies and money to be able to do that, to be able to transform those fallow lands into lands that can regrow. So anyway, that's kind of like where I've been seeing as a really great solution that we can all start to do on our own little small levels too.
Right on, yeah. And you know, the agricultural subsidies, I mean, heaven forbid we should start talking about not giving subsidies to those large-scale production system, agricultural systems that are using such mass amounts of pesticides. What a great way to reorient in a, you know, from a policy level. You know, obviously, you know, I've been buying organic to the extent I can and trying to support that. And, you know, I've got my own little, I've converted a piece of gravel dry, parking lot in my at my house where I live to garden and planted some trees, and yeah, all that stuff's great, but obviously these things are so big that it requires, so yeah, I mean, there's many subsidies that are going to most of the wrong things. Anyway, Great, thank you for calling, for starting off the conversation, Jen. Looks like you've sparked a couple other people to call in, so hopefully I'll talk to you again sometime. Thanks
Paul.
Who do we got up next? Looks like we got Thomas. Go ahead. You're on there, Thomas.
Oh. Thanks for bringing the call, or, you know, taking the call, Paul. Yeah, my name's Thomas, and I am also I'm a show host and a DJ for a program called Eclectic Pandemic on a KBOO that airs every fourth Monday at 11. And I've been listening to your show, and I was listening this morning, and you were talking about the sense of urgency, you know, regarding, you know, action, taking action, and, you know, and on a interpersonal level as well, and that really hit me. and it brought a tear to my eye. And I just wanted to let you know that your show does that for me. And you have that voice also that King had to me, because it got me to reach out and call you, and that's something I normally would never do.
Right on. Thank you.
Yeah, so it really was just to thank you for your program. And I did, when we were doing the Grass is Greener spring drive, I was putting a commercial together for my program, and it was, it was regarding, how KBOO keeps the grass greener. And to me, that was really easy to do. But I put some Martin Luther King quotes throughout the commercial, and or the promotional commercial for KBOO and for the drive. And it brought everything together. And I wish I could play it for you right now, but I believe the quotes were action against injustice, peace and love, unity and respect. And there was another one in there as well, but Martin Luther King was a special person, and I think you have that spark in the morning, so thanks again.
Wow, well, I obviously any comparison to Martin Luther King, I would have to demur on personally, but I hear what you're saying. You know, we get the inspiration where we can. There's a lot of, there's people on the radio on KBOO. There's a lot of voices on KBOO that get me inspired and get me thinking and get me going. And other places, there's people in my personal life. There have been, and it's we have to honor that, but obviously not. The problem is sometimes when we especially in death, we sort of tend to deify people in a way that, makes it sort of unfortunately gives in to our tendency towards vicarious living. And I think that's what sometimes strong figures do, is we tend to live through them, or movements and organizations, instead of necessarily participating, we applaud them, we cheerlead them, I think it's always kind of a double-edged sword. And then there's the charismatic people who inspire the wrong sorts of passions, which we see as another thing I kind of want to talk about.
Right.
It's sometimes who has the loudest voice, or who has the biggest megaphone. Anyway. That's
you had mentioned, there's political action, we have our personal, actions that need to be taken, and all these other types of situations that enter into our lives, and on a huger scale, on a local, on a community, all the way down to our homes. And taking that action in the first step into the direction where we need to go is sometimes the hardest, and it's important that facing your fears, because like you had said, if not now, when?
Indeed. And how, and of course then the taking the correct action is also very important. Well, anyway, thank you for keeping the conversation going, Thomas. Always good to hear new people. I'm glad I sparked you to call in, and looks like we got another couple people, so we'll carry on the conversation. Good talking to you. We got Elliot up next. Go ahead, Elliot. You're on the air.
Thank you. This is maybe an overly concrete interpretation of the fierce urgency of now, but since you're one of at least the two main environmental programs on KBOO, I thought I'd alert your audience to a new art exhibit that was actually discussed as a crosstalk on your art show yesterday at Northwest 29th and Northwest Industrial is an art center. And there's a large scale sculpture installation, kind of symbolically asking the question of whether there'll be a soft landing for climate change. and it's a bunch of little earth beach balls dropping from the ceiling towards cushions at various places in a big maze on the floor that's made from sand, like a sand mandala, with a big sculptured Darwin moth, kind of the moth that changed from white to black when the coal in Manchester polluted the trees. In a tent, sort of, you know, to negotiate the maze.
So you're saying people should go see this?
It's a very interesting installation by a Ms. Roll.
Okay.
So it's Northwest, the Art Center, Northwest 29th and Northwest Industrial, and maybe even want to, you know, talk to her on your show.
I'll give that some consideration. Thank you.
Yeah, she's going to have it open, I think, Thursday in the afternoon and Friday evening.
Well, great. I appreciate that.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you for calling in. Okay, well, that was Elliot. We had Thomas and we had Jen. Now we got Mark up. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning, Paul. Thanks so much for your program. Every week you really enable us to discover the prophetic and to discuss why traditions are being blocked or buried, the traditions of resistance, the traditions of a civil community. I mean, to me, business as usual means disaster capitalism. It means no help for the homeless. We're witnessing a state, an inert state, that simply looks away from the homeless for 2 years and doesn't do one thing, doesn't even make one development. One village of SROs, you know, would be a sign that we have spirit and that we learn from Martin Luther King and from progressive forces, that we learn from environmental realities and from the corporate malfeasance. You know, it's hard to debate and debate the subject of wealth and poverty when the wealthy conceal their wealth.
So what are we going to do?
Well, I mean, we have to hope for incremental change, and that is for villages of SROs. This is an imperative. I think we're in a push button society where people expect, you know, complete answers, complete solutions. Well, this is a vital step. You know, to me, well, Martin Luther King spoke about how we are approaching moral death if we prefer the arms race to the human race. And right now, of course, the Congress accepted a $770 billion arms military budget and has canceled social programs. And so that is very bizarre and very perverse. You know, a person like Ted Kennedy did speak out against the resistance to minimum wage increases. He was kind of vicious, you know. He asked, when is enough? Well, I'm very thankful for those voices of protest and anger.
Okay, well,
but thanks for your passion.
Well, I get on the radio and I talk, and that's something. But I really appreciate the people who are out there, directly giving aid to the houseless people who are, you know, bringing meals and bringing clean socks and stuff, and the people who are advocating for, you know, or helping to organize the villages that do exist. There are still some, tiny home villages, and there's, you know, there has been some, but yeah, I mean, it's an intractable problem that people don't want to talk about, the issue of the fact that they're, you know, $1 million, $2 million mansions in the city of Portland, and then there's people living on the streets. And is there a disconnect? I mean, and the fact that there's the ten most richest men in the world have like doubled their wealth in the during the pandemic,
and Jeff probably Bezos has a $500 million yacht.
It's true.
Well, thanks for bringing up Martin Luther King, and for you know urging us to make the connections, and not to give in to hopelessness.
Indeed.
Resignation, right?
Well, we got a couple other callers.
Okay, thanks very much.
Thank you for calling, Mark. And yeah, I've been talking about the fierce urgency of now and how to, you know, I guess my as I've said, you know, I have participated in direct action movements that sort of took on a life of their own, and you know, it's really just a sometimes just a few people who started. You know, whether it was sitting in trees or blocking roads or, you know, I was, you know, I joined in on the early days of the Don't Shoot Portland, which kind of morphed into the Black Lives Matter movement. And, you know, part of the whole effort to rethink the police, which has now sort of gotten mired into the terrible partisan politics of the day, but still has really changed the debate. And I admire those people in the African-American communities around the country where their fellows have, their community members have been gunned down and they've risen up. And, you know, those are the movements of our day. And I've seen these things start from very little. I've seen things start from sometimes just one or two people. I was reading about a guy in, I think, before the free speech movement, he did a solitary fast on the steps, I think, of Sproul Hall before that became the kind of the locus of activism, and really helped, you know, really helped jumpstart the peace movement. You know, and so we don't know. Sometimes just, you know, one person taking an action will spark other people, and a small group forming and starting to take regular actions. We never know. So I encourage people to feel that urge, that inner urge to take action, to join in with other people. You know, we've seen great success here in the Portland area in terms of climate change activism shutting down. You know, we despite the fact that this thing continues to grind on and accumulate the damages, we must hold to the actions that we're taking that are having resonant effect. And so I applaud that. So anyway, let's keep on keeping on. We got a couple more callers. First, Robbie, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, good morning. Thank you for the conversation, and I really, I have to say I totally thank you for your direct action, and, you know, and it's honestly, Portland is one of the better places. It's really great seeing the community when little things like that start, you know, spark up. But that being said, I have to mention this. I haven't heard much of it, but the assassination of MLK is something that I feel it's like a subject that we can't, we're not like allowed, like people just kind of skirt over it.
Well, I heard your interchange with Tracy and Joe and Abe yesterday on these airwaves at this time, and I don't know, we'll take it a step further. Tracy seemed to say that there really was no hard evidence to, you know, I'll just restate the argument, which is basically that you,
I'll make it quick. You know, the thing is I don't want to waste time. You know, I'm not going to sit here and pretend that I do know what happened. But what I will say is, if you respect the Martin Luther King family, then you should know about William Pepper. William Pepper represented the Martin Luther King family in prosecuting. In 1999, they took the Memphis police to court. So this is a court case where they proved that the Memphis police were conspiring with the military and National Guard. And there's all sorts of evidence that he presented to that case. So I'm not going to sit here and speculate. I'm going to say this is a actual legitimate court case where Martin Luther King's family took James Earl Ray to court, and for $100 they convicted him of allowing that to happen at his hotel, because it was either his diner or his hotel that one of the other whistleblowers, there's all sorts of whistleblowers. Anyway, William Pepper is the person, and that was, it was frustrating because I think that accountability,
James Earl Ray was the accused assassin.
I'm sorry, what was that?
James Earl Ray was the accused assassin.
There was he was the, yeah, exactly, and William Pepper was his initial lawyer.
Oh, okay.
And on his deathbed, James Earl Ray was ranting and raving about how he was innocent, and sure enough, they found, I forgot, but William Pepper ended up having this other guy's name. I'm at work right now.
Well, let me just cut it to the quick. The takeaway is that you're convinced that the state was responsible, you know, the FBI, the military, whatever, for Martin Luther King's assassination, and on their
Martin
show,
Martin Luther King's family is
right.
Martin
I understand what you're saying, but I'm just trying to cut to the quick, and because we can't resolve this, because, you know, on the Tracy and Abe show yesterday, Tracy was saying that there is actually no firm evidence. I'm not sure if she's read all these books and evaluated all this, and I can't speak for her, and I can't speak for you. Let me just finish this thought. And so I'm just saying, I believe that it's entirely probable that something like that happened. Whether or not, I haven't reviewed the evidence, so I can't agree or disagree with you. You're putting it out there for people to say, and I agree that it is important. It is, you know, these things should be resolved. It should be, you know, all these, you know, finally it came, you know, finally there was some light shed on Malcolm X's assassination. It came out that they finally absolved the two people who had been in prison. I think one of
them. Are you aware
that
Malcolm X's daughter is now gone?
I wasn't aware.
Did you know about that?
No.
Yes, that happened right after it came out just recently that the assassination of Malcolm X was probably also done by the FBI. And when their killers were exonerated, and she started pressing to reopen investigation, she is now gone. So this is stuff that I think is important that we need to be talking about, and we need to be, you know, pointing out, because in my mind, I don't think it will ever stop unless we do, you know, we can catch it. We can stop to say, hey, this is a weird death that we are just wiping under the rug, pretending and dancing around as if it never happened.
Okay, and well, we got a couple other callers. And,
thank you.
And no, I appreciate it. I think it is important to bring this up. I know there's people who've covered that extensively. In fact, exactly the case you're talking about and some of the books you're talking about. And yes, and I unfortunately haven't delved into it to the extent that I can feel comfortable making any definitive statement one way or the other. But I certainly know that the state has done worse even than that, and, you know, created pretext for starting wars. And, you know, what now is ironically that the U.S. is accusing, I think it was on CNN, I saw somebody talking about the danger that Russia will create a pretext for going in and invading Ukraine. Is like, well, you know, where did they learn that from, if that indeed happens. Anyway, we got two more callers, Bill and then Linz. So let's go to Bill. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Good morning. Interesting conversation. I'm interested in the narrative, and I think I'm going to kind of add on to what your last caller said with respect to how we receive information. I think in America, when we talk about these small homeless communities, we don't see them as collectives of people who have a common interest. And if houselessness is their problem, then they're at the forefront of it. And I think that's the same for community radio, a collective, right? And I think we need to change the conversation around the need for these micro collectives to have a voice. And I think for a long time in America, there has been like this campaign to discredit So when we talk about communes or a collective of the past, they were always criticized with people being crazy. And yet today, as we get away, individualism is, and this crazy thing about creating wealth has led to many of the problems we have. And unless the collective can gain a foothold in the conversation, be it political, economic, social, all of those things, I think we are going to continue to have problems where there are these individual pockets of people who are underserved.
No, that's a very interesting point you bring up. I agree with you that this extreme individualism of modern capitalist American and many other societies is the water we swim in, the air we breathe, and we don't know how to get out of ourselves and actually join. And that was one of the big problems of the communal movement, which was really quite amazingly large in the late 60s, yeah, early 70s. Part of the problem was a lot of people weren't actually that prepared for it. There's a lot of, you know, a lot of those communes failed because they didn't have the people with the experience in order to deal with the kinds of difficulties that come up when you've got a lot of, you know, individuals coming together.
But at the same time, so when I think about what we are calling homeless encampments, are they no different than a commune, right? Where these people have come together.
Well, do you have experience? Do you have any experience? Because I'm really curious. Because I think I imagine there's kind of a continuum. I see ones that seem from the outside to be pretty quote functional, where it seems like people must be getting along pretty well in order to, you know, they've been there long enough and they, you know, there's
not. Well, it's not that I have my social experience. So this homeless crisis that we're talking about right now, I grew up in Southern California in the 80s. And as a young kid, this homeless issue was already widespread in Southern California. So I saw this growing up. And it wasn't until governments, you know, usually it was police crackdowns in the 80s. And it didn't resolve the issue. So my point, there was an earlier caller who spoke about, you know, the issue of homelessness and what governments were not doing. And I think that, you know, maybe it's government support and maybe it's community support that these communities are going to need in order to become viable, to become safe. Or because if houselessness is going to be an issue going forward, then all we can do is figure out, should they be entitled to government services, no different than any other community, right? So I'm not an expert on this. I'm just a person looking at a problem and saying that if it's continued to be neglected, we see what the outcomes have been. But are they still not citizens entitled to services? And for the communities who don't want to see this, this is just the stark reality we live in. So do we provide services to help individuals transition? Do we support these communities so that they're clean and safe? If we're spending money inadvertently to try to wipe them away, then why not spend money to support it? Because I don't think houselessness is going away anytime soon.
Well, no, I think the capitalism is a terrible, terrible crisis point that doesn't seem to be able to be resolved. I think the more likely, you know, we see signs that people are wanting it to be resolved in a fascistic, authoritarian way, which is the big danger. And the alternative is, you know, ground up self-organization, and that's what I like to see. But the issue is, you know, private property's a huge issue. You know, having the continuity, there has to be the ability for places to be able to, people to be able to hold on for a longer period of time. I mean, and maybe we need to not look at them as necessarily transitional. There's maybe we need to look at totally different models for how we live together, how we live in the environment. So maybe we need to Well, we need to completely rethink the idea of private property itself. And, you know, maybe we need to turn over, you know, some of that land to people so they can actually, you know, yeah, there's a lot of interlocking questions. So I'm glad you brought all that up. But we are out of time. We are out of time for both you and the next caller, Lynn, so I can't let talk because we are out of time. Been a good conversation. Thank you, everybody, for calling. Thank you, everybody, for listening to me. Goodbye, all.
You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. The time is 8:58 a.m. Next up is Fight the Empire. Hello, KBOO. Thank you.